I'm extremely pleased to introduce Tom Hay from the University of Lancaster, who's an AHRC-funded PhD student there, researching representations of eating disorders in contemporary literature through this intersecting framework of the medical humanities, post-colonial theories, and affect theories. Take it away, Tom.
Thank you very much. And thank you, everyone, for being here this morning, bright and early. So I'm delighted to be speaking to you here today. I'm going to be speaking about phenomenology and bulimia. So while phenomenology has been central to putting together this paper, I'm a literary critic first and foremost, and so the primary focus of this paper will be a close reading of a literary text which depicts bulimia. However, the resources of phenomenology have been invaluable in providing a vantage point from which to open up this literary text. So I'm hopefully going to demonstrate how phenomenology and literary criticism can work in conjunction to provide a richer understanding of experiences of bulimia. So you will have to excuse me if my phenomenology is a bit rusty. This paper will be structured as follows. I'm going to start with a brief overview of some phenomenological approaches to illness generally, before summarising phenomenological approaches to eating disorders. I will then introduce the phenomenological framework which I will be using in my close readings, namely the work of Sarah Ahmed. I will then introduce the literary text that I will be analysing, a collection of short accounts of bulimia titled Bulimics on Bulimia, and I will then provide some close readings of this text using the phenomenological frameworks before offering some concluding remarks. So I will start by overviewing phenomenological approaches to illness. Javier Carrel's Phenomenology of Illness argues that a naturalistic account of disease needs to be supplemented with a philosophical study of the experience of illness. This is because a naturalistic biomedical account of disease fails to fully apprehend what it is like to be ill, the day-to-day experiences of illness, and as such can only partially succeed in administering treatment for the ill person. An exclusively biomedical account of disease ignores much of what it is to be ill. Carrel goes on to explain why phenomenology is up to this task of supplementing a naturalistic account of disease. She writes that illness disrupts how someone experiences the world and how she inhabits it, and that phenomenology is a process for improving our understanding of both the general and concrete aspects.
Sorry to interrupt, the screen sharing isn't working online, so you can continue and I'll just middle on and sort this in the background.
Okay. The phenomenology is a process for improving our understanding of both the general and concrete aspects of illness. Phenomenology also places high value upon emotion and anecdote, which are often overlooked in biomedicine but are essential to understanding human experiences. She also argues that phenomenology allows us to both understand ourselves better and direct our attention towards others in thoughtful empathy. While phenomenology should not replace a biomedical approach to illness, it can productively supplement it by tending to experience an emotion, which leads to self-understanding and can prompt empathetic relations with others. What is interesting for my purposes is that phenomenology and literature fulfill similar functions in relation to illness. Written accounts of illness can offer insight into the experiences of illness which are absent from naturalistic accounts. They center emotion and anecdote and can lead to self-understanding as well as increased empathy. Literature and phenomenology can thus mutually support one another in supplementing naturalistic accounts of disease. So now I will look at phenomenological approaches to eating disorders. This quote by Rebecca Lester summarizes the value of these approaches. She argues that phenomenological models build on other models of eating disorders by focusing on the subjective, embodied experiences of eating disorders. And the ways people use them to negotiate interpersonal dynamics situated within structures of power. Phenomenology posits eating disorders as less to do with pathology, biology, or culture, more to do with interpersonal connectiveness and the experience of living in relationship with others. Lester's account resonates with Javier Carrel's argument in that phenomenology can supplement biomedical models by engaging subjective experiences of illness. Lester draws attention to how eating disorders are frequently issues of relatedness. Eating disorders affect one's ability to relate to the world and place strain on interpersonal relationships. Biomedical accounts might struggle to explain interpersonal aspects of eating disorders. Phenomenological accounts can add this nuance and specificity. Further, Hannah Bowden notes that eating disorders are defined phenomenologically, as one of the DSM-5's criteria for anorexia is a disturbance in the way in which one's body weight or shape is experienced. This highlights how experiences of embodiment are central to having an eating disorder. However, research into eating disorders often ignores first-person perspectives in favour of a biomedical third-person perspective. Dorothy Legrand notes that a focus on body weight and disturbed body image does not make sense from the anorexia patient's perspective, but does so only in the objective and objectifying world of the psychiatrist and or nutritionist. Phenomenologists question the lack of attention given to experiences of embodiment beyond simplistic claims related to bodily self-perception. I'm now going to outline my own use of phenomenology in the remainder of this presentation. In particular, I will use Sarah Ahmed's The Cultural Politics of Emotion. Ahmed's contribution to cultural theory is that she allows feelings and emotions as they are experienced through the body to be taken seriously. Emotions are not personal, private possessions, according to Ahmed, but rather exist in spaces between bodies and the world, and thus can tell us much about the constitution of subjectivity within social worlds. Ahmed's work fits into the broader field of affect theory, a subset of phenomenology which attempts to remedy a perceived absence of the body from cultural theory. Ahmed explores emotions in relation to orientations and attachments. She argues that subjects become, through various personal and social circumstances, oriented towards objects, and that orientations are accompanied by affective emotional attachments which move objects towards or away from one another. For Ahmed, emotions describe how we approach and experience other objects and constitute our perception of those objects. Emotions are not things we possess, are not characteristic of bodies, but exist in spaces between bodies and objects and come to mould and shape their boundaries. As such, by attending to effects and emotions, we can observe the relations between objects, how they affect one another, and expand our constraint and their capacities for action. The cultural politics of emotion is useful for understanding bulimia because it can draw attention to the experiential, embodied, and felt aspects of bulimia that are frequently absent from biomedical or sociocultural perspectives. Affect theory and phenomenology provide a way of looking at bulimia in which experience and emotion are foregrounded. Further, bulimia is often characterized by issues of relating to and connecting with the world, and Ahmed's description of emotions as negotiating between bodies can illuminate this relatedness in greater depth. Bodies and objects are transformed by the effects experienced by people with bulimia. So now I'm going to turn to the text, which I will interpret with all of this in mind. Bulimics on Bulimia, edited by Maria Stavrou, is a series of anonymous accounts, each shorter than 10 pages, written by bulimia sufferers, which documents their experiences of bulimia. It was published in 2009 and marketed as a must-read for counsellors, psychologists, and mental health professionals who wish to gain a more realistic impression of the day-to-day realities of living with bulimia. However, I believe the collection is also worthy of attention as a rich literary text. The tools of literary criticism and close reading, combined with those of phenomenology, can be applied to bulimics on bulimia to reveal much about the experiences of living with bulimia. Stavrou writes in her introduction that the book aims to provide insight into what life is like living with bulimia. The majority of books on bulimia are written retrospectively, she argues, and so do not provide such an accurate reflection of everyday life with bulimia. Instead functioning as reflections on the disease from a position of recovery detached from day-to-day struggles. Excuse me. She suggests that the collection engages women in all stages of the disorder to give a more well-rounded idea of the illness from a variety of perspectives. This introduction makes some important emphases. First, Stavrou foregrounds first-person lived experiences over third-person medicalized descriptions of bulimia, which makes phenomenology a productive lens through which to approach it. Stavrou also highlights the publishing industry's preference for retrospective accounts of bulimia, which becomes an obstacle to attending to lived experiences. Third, Stavrou emphasizes the importance of polyvocality. She moves away from the singular voice of the eating disorder memoir towards a collection of individual unique voices, which resist the generalizing tendencies of biomedicine. Finally, Stavrou situates suffering in the present tense by inviting writers currently suffering from bulimia. The difficult emotions which characterize the daily experiences of bulimia are foregrounded within the present tense rather than being resolved into a happy ending. The form of these stories is also significant. As Stavrou argues, much eating disorder writing takes the form of the retrospective memoir. Maria Hornbacher's Wasted and Roxane Gay's Hunger have been particularly well received within this genre. The success of these books is fantastic, but they elicit a particular kind of reading practice, one which focuses on the progression of illness over time, for example, which risks overlooking less narratively inclined aspects of bulimia. Shorter texts, such as those in Bulimics on Bulimia, require a different type of close reading. Sarah Wasson has explored alternative reading practices for illness stories, writing that some illness experience may require a parallel reading practice, reading less in search of narrative coherence or self-authorship, and more interested in the value of textual fragments, episodes, and moments considered outside a narrative framework. Longer texts should not be abandoned in favour of fragmentation. Memoirs have much to contribute to discussions of eating disorders. However, the exclusive focus on the memoir means that moments of incoherence and fragmentation are harder to acknowledge, giving a skewed idea of what living with bulimia might be like. Phenomenology, and especially Ahmed's affect theory, can be a fruitful means of accessing and engaging with moments of intensification which characterise these shorter texts. Now I will provide some close reading of Bulimics and Bulimia. I will focus on four accounts and look at moments in these texts which present the unfolding of the world from a bulimic perspective. In particular, I'm going to observe how bulimia transforms people's relationships with food and space. In Confession to My Roommate, A Day in My Life, the writer imagines confessing her bulimia to her roommate. She describes her consumption of food during a binge, writing that, "I inhale the food without honouring its value of nourishment, energy and taste. I stuff all my insecurities about not being thin, you know, smart, thin, pretty and charismatic into my mouth." Here, the writer recognises that, while others might appraise food for its nutritional content or taste, for her it represents insecurity and not being good enough. Read in terms of Ahmed, the writer is oriented towards food through an attachment of disrespect, which comes to shape both the writer and the food she consumes. This disrespect transforms the food into an object representing her insecurities rather than an object of nourishment. This destabilizes food. Instead of taste and nutrition being intrinsic to the food, the writer suggests that such qualities are dependent on a particular affective attachment. Food does not possess inherent properties, the writer suggests, but is bestowed with meaning depending on how the subject feels towards the food. Her bulimia attributes food with her feelings of insecurity, which become properties of the food itself. The next quotation suggests how the writer's body is likewise shaped by her relationship with food. She writes that, "When you have bulimia, you will not care if your body is nourished. When you no longer care for your body, you'll be numb to cram your stomach." By not honouring food as nourishing, the writer likewise does not honour her body as an object to be nourished, which transforms her body and what she does with it. Her feelings of carelessness towards her body transform it into a numb object, which makes it easier to abuse with binging. This seems to function cyclically. The less she cares for food, the less she cares for her body, which allows her to stuff it with food in a careless way. This all stems from the feelings of insecurity which the food stands in for. Both the food and the body become radically unstable objects within this affective economy. So this next account, An Addictive Personality, Food and Alcohol, also shows how food signifies differently from a bulimic perspective. The writer explains that the types of food she binges on. She eats ice cream, she writes, and the 2-litre tubs were very useful since they could be cleaned out and reused. This demonstrates that the object properties emerge differently depending on one's perspective. Where some might comment on the taste or texture of ice cream, the writer describes it as very useful because it comes in containers which she can purge into, clean out, and reuse. Food is noteworthy for how it facilitates the writer's bulimia. Later, the writer explains that she likes to binge chocolate because it comes in small boxes, which makes it easier to hide from her mother and is not individually wrapped, so can be eaten more quickly. Again, the properties that food appears to possess relate to how it facilitates her illness. Packaging is emphasised over taste or nutrition, since food's primary function is to be binged and purged quickly and discreetly, rather than to be tasted or digested. The world unfolds for the writer from a bulimic perspective, which makes the world appear radically different than from a non-bulimic perspective. These writers provide a bulimic phenomenology of food, in which the properties that food seems to possess reflect its ability to be binged or purged. Writers also suggest how space is transformed by bulimia. In Binging and Purging to Stay Alive, the writer explains how the shame associated with purging transforms the spaces she inhabits. She writes that the library was no longer a place to study, but a place to purge when I felt too ashamed to purge in the dorm bathrooms again. We can return to Ahmed here and introduce her concept of stickiness. Ahmed argues that affects or emotions describe contact between objects, and when objects repeatedly come into contact with each other, these effects stick to implicated objects and appear as their properties. Stickiness is, in Ahmed's words, an effect of the histories of contact between bodies, objects, and signs. If an object seems to possess an affective quality, it's likely that this object has been in historical contact with an object which provokes this feeling in an affective agent. So to return to this example, the act of purging is experienced as shameful by the writer, and this repeated enactment of this shame-inducing practice in the dorm bathrooms means that shame sticks to this space, and thus the space itself appears shameful. The writer begins purging in the library as a reprieve from the shame of the dorm bathroom, which transforms the library from a space of learning to a space of purging to which shame will eventually stick itself. This circulation of effects between bodies, actions, and spaces posits a highly subjective, dynamic relationship between the writer and her environments in which both are destabilized. Self and space are subject to fluctuation through the sticking of effects. So in this next account, the lesbian bulimic mafia demonstrates the unfolding of the world from a bulimic perspective. The writer explains that she enjoys the tightly controlled schedule of her bulimia, how she has to calculate which route to take around town to pass as many sandwich shops as possible, and what to put in the oven so it'd be ready just as she was finishing with something else. The world becomes a puzzle that she must solve to facilitate her bulimia to the best of her ability. The writer explains that she enjoys this puzzle, which suggests that bulimia makes the world more vibrant and exciting for her because it becomes a puzzle. While bulimia can transform the world into a shameful, horrifying place, this need not be the case, as this example demonstrates. Bulimia can make the world a more enjoyable space to exist within also. It is clear from these examples that what the world looks like and how writers feel towards it is influenced by bulimia. The properties of space, as with those of food, are dependent on particular affective relations, which is destabilizing and transformative. So I would like to close by considering some implications of what I've discussed. First, there is a clear necessity of taking an individualized approach to bulimia, since the objects people come into contact with and how they feel towards those objects is unique to the individual, and different accounts can contradict one another. It becomes more difficult to make generalized, depersonalized claims about bulimia from a phenomenological perspective. Second, it's essential to respect difference. How the world unfolds depends on one's particular circumstances, which is often beyond one's control and is highly personalized. It is important to respect how others perceive the world, despite its inaccessibility between different people. Third, this knowledge has been generated by taking the feelings of people with bulimia seriously and considering the implications of those feelings. It is vital that understandings of bulimia incorporate feeling, otherwise they will be detached from the day-to-day experiences of living with the illness. And finally, I hope I've been able to demonstrate the value of literature and close reading for a phenomenological understanding of illness. Literature can provide a unique insight into the experiences of illness, and understandings of bulimia can be enriched by incorporating literary perspectives.